It's time for Intersections, where art and science meet, your weekly hour of conversation, where you learn about curious ideas, creative works, and interesting phenomena with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman-Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Now, it's time for Intersections, where art and science meet.
I'm Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, where we create a museum without walls so scientists, artists, and the community can create unique interactions and conversations. In today's conversation, we're going to be talking about how landscapes and documenting the world around ourselves, it can change over time. And we're looking at our guest's work based on observing and documenting the world around her as it unfolded. And her artistic and scientific journey ultimately led to a new understanding of how we must live in relationship to the land. Wow. With us today is Robin Lee Carlson, who's the author and natural science illustrator, who has an upcoming new book called The Cold Canyon Fire Journals. Welcome, Robin.
Thanks so much for having me, Mark. I'm really excited about the conversation.
Yeah, this is great. So I'm just blown away by the book that you did, and we'll get into that in a minute. But I'm really interested how you moved from natural science illustrator, which I know you do, and moved into that. And then you did your kind of merged with your life, right, of walking around and going in natural places and observing. And how did you merge those together and then all of a sudden become a writer too?
That is a good question. So I'm going to go back slightly further, actually, in sure. my history, because that's sort of formed some of the basis of that answer. So originally, I was a scientist. I got a master's degree in evolutionary biology and had been planning on continuing on to get a PhD and become an academic scientist and do research. And I realized in the process of working on the graduate degree that while I enjoyed doing research and I really did love coming up with research questions, the thing that I loved absolutely the most was figuring out how to communicate what people had found in their research with other people. And so it was fun when it was my own research, but I also really enjoyed the sort of the library research projects of trying to wrap my head around one particular question in a field and put all of that information together and then present that in a way that was easy to understand and written in plain English and, you know, using as little jargon as possible. And so I decided that I didn't really want to end up in academia and that I really wanted to pursue communication a whole lot more in my career. And so I worked for a long time on data projects and got a lot of experience in translating numbers and research that way into things that people could understand and using maps to help convey information. But what I really wanted to do was make things, to develop an even more personal connection between me and my audience, because I think that there's a lot of value in being able to put yourself into these sometimes really abstract scientific concepts that you're trying to communicate with people. And I think that while we all see science as something that we all have to maintain some sort of objective distance from in order to be able to do science well, I think it's also really important to put ourselves back into it as we try to communicate it, because there's a lot of a lot more that people can gain from a personal perspective into scientific concepts. And so I wanted to return to visual art, which I had always sort of done as a hobby on the side, and I wanted to be able to bring that more into how I communicated science. And so in order to do that, in order to sort of develop into a career as an illustrator first, I thought what I really wanted was a project where it, you know, something that I came up with, something that I was really personally motivated by and invested in, that would allow me to do a lot of artwork, you know, just for myself, but then have that to share and as a way to show people what I could do to, you know, eventually get paying illustration work as well. And because my interest in biology and the natural world has always been focused on change. I was studying evolutionary biology originally in school because I was interested in change on a large scale. How did the world get to be the way that it is now? Why are ecosystems set up the way that they are? Why do organisms look the way that they do? So I was interested in change on a large scale. And also on a smaller scale, how do individual organisms develop over the courses of their lives, and how does that fit into evolution? How does that fit into their ecosystems? And so I was looking for some way that I could observe the natural world around me changing. And so, you know, I'd been thinking of all sorts of things related to climate change. What could I follow? What could I document in images and drawings? And the a natural reserve a half an hour from my home burned in 2015. And it slowly dawned on me after that fire that here was a natural area that was going to be undergoing some really obvious rapid changes after that fire, and that this would be a perfect way to watch change for myself on a relatively short time frame, and to document it in drawings, and so that way I would learn a whole lot about fire ecology, and then I would also develop a nice body of illustration work. And so originally I did the project just to see where it would go. I went up monthly after the fire to see what things looked like. I did not have more than a very basic understanding of fire ecology. I was definitely not going into this with a whole lot in the way of preconceived notions about what I was going to see. And I tried to approach it as a blank slate and just let myself be caught by whatever it was that I happened to see and have questions about and notice and want to explore further. And so the purpose originally was, you know, to sort of develop my naturalist knowledge of this one area to understand fire ecology better and to develop a body of work and drawings. And as time went by, I continued to visit, approximately monthly, and did learn an enormous amount about fire ecology and really had my perspectives changed dramatically over the course of the next 5 years about exactly what it meant to recover after fire, and whether it really is even recovery or if there wasn't actually something terrible that needed to be recovered from in the first place. And so it sort of became clear that there was a whole lot of story there in both in what was happening to this landscape, to these habitats, what was happening to my own understanding of fire ecology, and some perspectives that I thought were really, really valuable to share with the, you know, with the rest of the world, because it was definitely not a way that I went into this thinking. And so, yeah, go ahead.
No, Robin, if you're willing, I'm going to read just a part of the introduction.
Fantastic. Yeah. Book,
because it speaks to exactly what you were talking about in it. And it says, I am hiking along a dusty trail in early January. Mid-morning, the light slanting down into the canyon cast my shadow far ahead, and it precedes me down the path. The gentle winter sunlight falls on starkly exposed earth. Almost no leaves remain to block it. What the light exposes are the signs of a recent fire. Blackened stumps and twisting branches, alternating swaths of black and white ash, vivid spots of sienna where the dirt is freshly exposed, the leaves of re-sprouting plants coming up in flashes of green here and there amid the black and brown remain very low to the ground, just getting started. I think that's poetic and beautiful. And I think you captured exactly what you just were talking about in your journey, that you're first devastated, right? Because you go out to this place that you've been normally walking, and all of a sudden there was a huge fire. What were your thoughts when you first walked into that space after the fire?
Yeah, so absolutely. And it's not like I have stopped actually having this reaction when I hear about a particular place, especially a place that I know here that there's been a fire. It's like, oh my goodness, that's terrible. It's, you know, this beautiful place is gone. And I certainly temper that more now than I used to, but that was certainly my reaction after Cold Canyon. I had been hiking there since I was a kid. It was familiar and beautiful, and it was like, oh, what a really sad thing. You know, I know, of course, it will recover one day, but this is such a sad thing. And so it was, I mean, it definitely did not immediately have that perspective changed when I was first walking there after the fire. I think absolutely seeing the green things that return so quickly was definitely the first sort of shift in thinking, because I definitely didn't picture the regrowth that happens that fast. It's very different looking at a hillside that has burned off in the distance and walking through that same area, because it of course completely depends on the fire and how it behaved, but very, very infrequently does absolutely everything burn. And so one of the other surprises in hiking in Cold Canyon is all of the patches that hadn't burned at all. And you could walk into a little clump of trees and not realize that everything else around that had burned. And so really actually experiencing for myself the patchiness of the way that wildfire often operates. Of course, that is not universal. Of course, there are times when everything completely gets burned away, but most of the time there's this variation in how things are burned. And then even in a place that I think of as being incredibly hot and dry in the summer, it gets so dry there. The creek that runs through this canyon is a seasonal creek, and so it's completely underground not in all of the canyon, but in a large stretch of it is underground. You don't see any water. And so you think of this place as being completely dry. But a fire that happens in summer, immediately green things are coming up. Even in the middle of the summer, when you think, well, surely I'm not going to see anything till we've seen some rain. And so that really points out two interesting things. One of which is that the shrubs that are in this chaparral habitat have a lot of things stored in their roots and in their burls at the bases of their trunks, enough so that even if there weren't much water at all in the ground, they would still have the resources to send up green shoots right away. And the other thing was understanding just how much water there actually still is in that system underground that we don't see, that it's very hard to keep in mind that even though it feels incredibly parched and dry when we're hiking there in the summer, there's still actually water underground running down the hillsides, and the trees and the shrubs are still tapping into that, and are also regrowing, you know, using water that really is there that we can't see. And so suddenly it's made visible to us that there's all this water in the system.
Right. And you're talking really about three significant things there. You've got that the water is always underground in places. It may be closer to the ground or further away, but plants have the ability to put that down pretty far. And the second one is that you were thinking that plants also in a place that gets dry, plants have these abilities to store extra resources in both water and food. But the third one I think is really interesting, and that is that the fire actually produces an ash that creates a fertilizer for young plants and seeds to come in, so long as, you know, it happens pretty quickly. And so it's amazing to me that nature has these three mechanisms, you know, water, stored water, which means some of those that were burned at the top can regrow. And then you've got the other, it's just an amazing story. And then your second part of that is just the idea, and you're right, I've done that, and you go, well, why did this not burn? Or we think about it like in any other catastrophe, right? Like a tornado goes through somewhere. Right. And why did this building not get blown down? Everything else did.
Yeah.
And what is unique about that? And that's patterns. Wow, that's just a really great description, Robin.
Thank you.
Where it takes me to now is thinking, you've got this different perspective. So you went and visited it over and over again. Are you still visiting?
Yes.
Your walk?
Yep. Okay. Still going up there. And that brings up the fact that it burned in 2015, and then I started this project, and then it burned again in 2020. So I would be visiting it still regardless, but I've had this sort of very impressive natural experiment being conducted where I have been watching after the second burn, watching with completely different set of eyes, because now I do have a lot of specific questions going into it, things that I didn't know to be watching for after the first one, things that I wasn't there at the right time for, and then a whole lot of questions about, well, there was only 5 years between burns. That's a totally different thing than 30 years, which it had been since it had burned before. And so I have even more motivation to keep going there and trying to do it regularly enough to feel like I'm catching some of these shifts that are happening and that are different this time.
You know, I think our listeners are similar to us in thinking about, you know, you think of the devastation and you think of that, but then you forget that really nature has mechanisms built into it for recovery. And, you know, we get doom and gloom about the planet not being here and other things. It might be just that it's just us that might not be here, that the planet might just actually have mechanisms to recover if we weren't continually doing something with it. But I love the idea of fire ecology. I love the idea that there are certain things only that live because there's a fire occasionally. And so fires occurred naturally. Is your experience such that some of what happens is that we have tried to protect forested areas from fires too much, allowing stuff to build up? Is that an issue for you out there at least?
Yeah. So for, interestingly, a lot of the debate about fire frequency is much more focused in forests than in this habitat. So just a brief description of this ecosystem. It's in the California Coast Ranges, and it is a oak woodland and chaparral habitat. And so it is very different than the forests, for example, in the Sierra, not far from where I live, but the opposite direction to the east. The question about fire frequency, it completely depends on the habitat and the ecosystem that you're talking about. And so in these, and even between the two different main habitats in Cold Canyon, it's different answers about what was, what kind of fire frequency those habitats evolved with. So for the oak woodlands, they evolved with and do really well with fairly frequent low intensity fires that does a lot of good things for the oaks in keeping down acorn pests and making it so that oaks have what they need to grow most optimally. Chaparral habitats don't want fire as frequently. 30 years is like the bare minimum interval for healthy fires in chaparral. And then also what's best for what has evolved in the chaparral are much more intense fires, because the high intensity fires help keep out the non-native grasses and also helped keep out native grasses too before Europeans brought all of these other grasses that have taken over the state. It's still the chaparral shrubs and other plants that evolved in the chaparral in order for them to not get outcompeted by any kind of grasses. High intensity fires, but less frequent, are more helpful. So this has been, So none of that really answers the question about the forests, because that's definitely not been my, my personal observation. But it is absolutely true that what I've been learning about here is this more general principle of, in all of the West, you know, all of these habitats evolved with fire to one degree or another, but it really, really varies from region to region, and depending on the climate of that area, and depending on what species evolved in that area, what the healthy range is. But the answer is all of them do want fire at some interval. They've all evolved to deal with it and to need it, because there are species in all of these habitats that totally require fire for their life cycles. And so that was definitely the biggest shift of all was, of course, I understood that Western habitats had evolved with fire and could cope with fire, but really understanding fire as just as important, you know, the recently burned habitat as just as important, just as beautiful, just as needed by species as the, you know, full lush green shrubs and trees habitat, was definitely the biggest shift in perspective in looking at this burned habitat with fresh eyes as this is like, you know, there's a particular mouse that only, you know, that is most abundant in this habitat. So it's looking at this landscape like, yes, I've finally got exactly what I need. And woodpeckers are super excited because this is what they've been waiting for. And thinking of all of the species that have just been waiting for this is such an exciting way of being able to think about burned landscapes.
Yeah. You know, a lot of our listeners are East Coast or Midwest. What's a chaparral? Can you describe it a little bit? We've all heard of it, but I don't know that we know what types of plants and animals live in it.
Yeah, that's an excellent question. So chaparral is a very shrub-dominated habitat. And so there are a bunch of just absolutely gorgeous shrubs in California that grow in the chaparral. So things like manzanita and ceanothus and mountain mahogany and chamise and toyone, just this really great variety of shrubs that that have all evolved to burn, not frequently, but to burn periodically. They all do best when they do burn periodically because it allows them to have a lot of the accumulated, they grow a very, very thick, dense overstory. So it's not a super tall overstory because these are shrubs. Some of them get fairly tall. Toyone are certainly taller than me. I'm about 6 feet and they're taller than I am, but a lot of the shrubs are around maybe my height or a little shorter, and they form a very, very thick canopy, which is wonderful shade for birds and lizards and mammals that live in this habitat. But they do get, you know, they become a dense thicket, and it is good to get that sort of cleared out. They are much healthier when they do burn back and grow again from their stumps. And so chaparral habitats are generally on not the most rich, fertile soils, and they're generally in a somewhat drier environment. And so these shrubs have a lot of great adaptations to deal with super hot, dry summers. They've got usually small leaves that don't lose as much water to evaporation. Then also they have these storage, you know, they have roots and bases of their trunks that are adapted for storing, as you mentioned before, both nutrition and both carbohydrates and water, so that they've got that stored up for the difficult summers. They've got it stored up for when they burn. And especially really to people in California too. I mean, a lot of times shrub habitats get overlooked because shrubs can be what forests turn into, for example, when they are disturbed too much, either by logging or by too many fires or too intensive fires or things like that. And so a lot of times people think of shrubs as these undesirable things that are coming in and taking over our more beautiful forested habitats. But it's really important to understand just how beautiful and how important they are in their own right. Of course, we don't want them to take over the forests, but we also don't want to lose them to grasslands. And especially since now in California, those are going to be non-native grasslands. I've been thrilled to become a whole lot more familiar with this type of habitat because it shelters an enormous abundance of birds and reptiles and amphibians and mammals that you know, really appreciate the dense canopy to hide in, and shrubs are wonderful food sources.
One of the really delightful things about the book is that you really, in a way, you follow some of these critters through different parts of the book. You'll follow them along through not making them human quality, but giving them a story, a life in there. What was your thinking on that? Because I think it really helps me to embrace not just facts, but to be more? What possessed you to do that?
Yeah, so it a lot of it is the way that I try to approach learning about any particular habitat or landscape is just trying to get outside of my own preconceptions about what is beautiful and what is important in nature. And so that was definitely my way in to being able to appreciate the landscape as something that, you know, would be actually the pinnacle, the absolute best part of ecological succession, was to be able to look around and say, you know, see western fence lizards that are out sunning themselves on blackened stumps and think, well, I look at that blackened stump and I think, oh my goodness, how sad that shrub is dead. because, you know, maybe it isn't resprouting yet. Maybe it's a kind of shrub that, I mean, not all of the shrubs in the chaparral resprout. Some of them do have to regrow from seed. So of course there are plenty of plants that truly did die in the fire. And so I look at it, oh my goodness, how sad, it's dead. And then look a little more closely and look at, maybe it isn't actually dead. Maybe it's perfectly fine too, but then also what is making use of it? So there are fungi that love burned wood, for example. So that burned wood is incredibly important food for fungi, for beetles that come, that are attracted to the fire and come and lay their eggs in this burned wood because it still is an excellent food source. And because the plant is either weakened or dead at that point, it can't mount its defenses against the beetles. So it's sort of like a free meal for the insects. And so being able to think about what it's like for, you know, that fence lizard out on this wonderful exposed branch because the canopy isn't there anymore because it burned. And so the lizard is basking in the sun. It's got these brand new insects that have come to the habitat that are delicious food. And, you know, letting go of the fact that I really like shade. I don't want to be in exposed sun. My own personal thought is, well, you know, things look dead and it's really bright and it's really hot and it's really uncomfortable. This is not where I would pick to hang out and have a wonderful time. But then realizing how many things around me think this is perfect. And so being able to, like you said, not in any way anthropomorphize them or, you know, turn them into anything other than what they are, but to try to help just put myself in their shoes, again, understanding that I don't actually know what it's like to be a lizard, but I think that following that, just that train of thought, the attempting to use my, you know, all of my observational powers to guess about what it might be to be a lizard, what be like to be a lizard, makes an enormous difference in how I then look at that landscape and then what kinds of questions I ask about it too, because all of a sudden I've opened up this whole other world of what is the lizard getting out of this habitat? What else is it looking for? You know, what does it need? What is it going to mean to the lizard as things grow back, as it gets shadier? And so then trying to guess at what it's like for the lizard is one thing, but then I think it's also been really, really valuable to think a lot about those chaparral shrubs too, especially the ones that don't die. The ones that though have just about completely burned up above ground, which is all I ever see of them. So that seems like that part of the shrub that was leafy and green and it had the flowers and it had the fruits, that's all gone. And so it seems to me like, well, that was obviously the most important part of that shrub, right? Because that's what I see. That's what I experience. You know, I don't have any concept of anything else, but then thinking about it, well, actually that shrub is perfectly happy to let that stuff go. You just let it go. That is not the most important. If you ask the shrub, the leaves, the fruits, those are critical parts. It can't lose them forever, but it can completely let them go. It's like cutting off my hair, except that that's not a good half of my body. But all the important parts are underground where we don't see them, we don't experience them, except for knowing that they're there. And so it has been a just a really important shift to make sure I'm always thinking about what I'm walking over, what is below me, because that's, for some of the things that live there, that is their most important parts, and everything above ground is expendable.
This is so exciting. I've been talking with Robin Carlson about her new upcoming book called The Cold Canyon Fire Journals, and we'll be right back.
Hi, this is Tony Morris. Join me for an hour of some of the best music for guitar on Classical Guitar Alive. Each week, we explore a wide variety of music with guitar, and you'll also hear interviews with many of the world's foremost performers and composers. That's each week on Classical Guitar Alive.
Saturday mornings at 5 on WICR, The Diamond.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Kiesling, and today I'm having a conversation with author and illustrator Robin Carlson. And Robin, a huge part of this book are these lush illustrations, which I wish, and you know, we can't because of publishing today and the cost, but I wish they were all in color, which I know a lot of them were, but they're really, really beautiful. And they do that. Did you approach the book as illustrator first and then start descriptions?
Oh yeah, I was just gonna say in the book they will all be color in the final.
Oh, they
book.
Will. Sorry,
yes.
Copy I have is black and white. Okay.
Yeah, no, the galleys were printed in black and white, but the final book will be completely color.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for that clarification. How did you approach it?
As I did this project, from the start, it really in the beginning was entirely a sketchbook drawing project. I wanted to both for myself use the drawing as a process tool for recording what I was seeing, for exploring and helping me figure out what my questions were about what I was seeing, and also just to draw things to learn all of the plants and animals that I was seeing there, to get more familiar with them and know what they were and what time of year they appeared. And basic questions like that. But then having my sketchbook with me and recording things as I visited each time so that I had this growing visual record of what I was seeing was absolutely the first the first goal of this, so that I would have these images for myself that were telling a story over time, and I would be able to go back and see how things were changing, and also see how my own approaches to things were changing, because it's not only a record of what was actually changing out there in the world, but it's very much a record of my own questions and process, and as my own understanding changes, that absolutely shows up in how I'm choosing to represent things on the page. But I also at the same time, so first for myself, but then very much as a communication tool, as a way of providing this really direct, immediate connection to anyone else who might be looking at the drawings, because absolutely my entire life, my favorite kind of artwork to look at from other people is the sketches, the process drawings, the things that really sort of invite you into the way that they are thinking, and the way that they are processing whatever it is that they're making art about. And so I think that there's this connection that you make between the artist and the audience when you're seeing the process of creating the art rather than just the finished art at the end. And so because I've always valued that when I'm looking at other people's art, I've also really viewed my own sketches and my own process drawings as really as my primary communication tool. I do plenty of finished artwork for illustrations, and that's valuable too. There's a lot to be said for being able to get everything right and exactly the way you want it. But I still think what communicates the most are the initial drawings, where things are not perfect, where there are mistakes, where you haven't necessarily captured something exactly right if you were to measure it out. But what you are seeing was my, how my direct experience of that, whatever I was drawing of that subject at the time that I was doing it. And there's, every time I redraw something based on a sketch, I think it loses a little bit of life. I think it has the initial drawing has by far the most life in it of anything. And so for this project, as I kept working on it, I had been starting to think about turning it into some kind of a book or some way of sharing the story more broadly, and had thought about doing final illustrations. But I think there's so much value in, especially because this is a book about a journey through time and through my own thoughts. I think seeing that as the actual sketches that I did along the way is really, really valuable. And so what I wanted to do with the book, again, rather than have sort of perfect final illustrations depicting the concepts of fire ecology, I wanted it to be the sketchbook pages themselves as I'm learning about this. And so that also sort of informed how I picked which pages from my sketchbooks got included and how they were included. I had originally been, maybe thinking more of pulling out individual sketches of individual plants and animals to go with where I talked about them in the book. But then I realized that as the writing that I was doing sort of evolved and became more of its own standalone thing, I realized that the sketchbook pages should stand on their own too, and each should be, relevant to each other in context, but that I would be including as many full sketchbook pages as I could so that the full context and experience of what I was standing there drawing is still there in the book. And you can see that as well.
Yeah. You did a really marvelous balancing act, I think, in the book, and in terms of I feel at times that I'm inside your nature journal because you have little notes as well,
right.
And along the way, and you've included those, and that also tells another narrative. You've got the illustrations that do, and every once in a while you punctuate with a more finished drawing,
right.
and that I see that. And then you've got this thing where you're sometimes narrative and sometimes you're poetic in what you're writing. So what's really fun for me is I feel like I'm journeying through the book at multiple levels. And I feel like as an artist, you've accomplished something for science that's really, really important in helping me to navigate really through your journey, through both your eyes, your ears, and all of your senses, really, because you do a great job of describing that for me.
I'm glad that comes across.
Well, thank you. I would think that's hard. That would be the hard thing about all this to do, would be to pull all that together.
Yeah. A lot of it was, speaking of journeys, just the journey of putting the book together too. A lot of it was just requiring sort of the time of having each of these realizations like, oh, I really can have whole sketchbook pages and let those stand, a little bit on their own, just like the narrative is really coming to stand. I mean, I when I started writing it, I felt much more like I was sort of narrating the drawings rather than it being a standalone text. And then as that evolved and I got more confident about the writing aspect of it and my ability to tell a story in words without actually, requiring the pictures and sort of letting them complement each other and instead of one supporting the other, that made a big difference. And I mean, it's always funny. You don't have the picture of the way things should be in the end, but just sort of waiting and giving that process the space that it needs to develop, it sort of all just becomes apparent. And that's very much how it felt like this went. Yeah.
Right. I think it leaves us with a mystery, right? There's a little, we don't know where the end point is yet. And
right.
I think that's the great thing about the book. I mean, it's still evolving.
Right.
The other thing I think is interesting, my normal experience with most authors has been where they write and then somebody gives them an illustrator.
Right.
This is really the reverse of that. And I don't know of too many that have done it this way, the way you have. You first were illustrating and keeping a field guide and notes, and it evolved into you having to write and be. So what were the challenges of doing that beyond, I know that you weren't at heart a writer.
Right.
But you really accomplished it. But what were the challenges of that? And then secondly, what were the challenges with a publisher where you're coming to them almost in the reverse of what they're used to? Right.
Yeah, it was. Sorry, there's a bunch of different answers to that question. I'm just figuring out where to start with first. So yeah, I mean, the biggest and most important thing, I'm going to start with the publisher, because Heyday, I think very consciously on their part too, understood that this was a project that was not something many publishers would think to take on.
Right.
And so, I mean, because I came to them without the writing, I came to them with the sketchbooks. But I mean, I think that just the topic and the journey was compelling enough that they were interested to see what might come of it. And then they gave me the opportunity to provide them with some writing, which I did. And that must have been promising enough that they were willing to work with me a bit on, you know, on sort of gently helping me to move away from just narrating the sketchbook, but to turning it into standalone writing. And so their confidence and faith in my ability to do that. So, I mean, this was done before they had committed to the book. This was them saying, well, you know, it needs to be more about your personal journey. And, you know, you need to bring in these things, and this is what we'd like to see. And me having a chance to sort of come back, I did two different sample writing drafts. But the fact that they thought that I could do that based on the writing that I sent them made a huge difference in me than being able to go and do that. So yeah, definitely the publisher was probably the most important part of that equation. And then some incredibly good advice about levels of storytelling. So that I think that's the other important aspect of this, was them saying exactly the right words at the right time to help, I mean, to just completely click as to how I needed to tell this story. And so saying there are three different levels of storytelling that you need to intermix here. You know, there's the scientific story that you're trying to convey. And then there's your own personal story. And then there's the stories of the landscape itself and what is changing there. And that all made perfect sense. And so, of course, it took a lot of work to actually, you know, figure out how to do that, but keeping that in mind as needing to weave all of those things together was absolutely what made it so that I could turn this into something literary that could stand on its own.
Yeah, it's just really amazing, and you can get the sense after you read it that you really first and foremost are following a nature journal. But it's also in your mind, a mind journal. And I think that's one of the things that makes it particularly special, what you've created. And because a lot of us want to go out and journal and do things, but what you've given us is a clue. I mean, the drawings are excellent. You're an illustrator. However, the drawings are also rough. And it also shows that any of us with whatever limited drawing skills, even if it was stick figures, we still have the ability to go out and do this. And is there a part of you that wanted to encourage people through this as well to get out and do their own journeys in nature?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yes, I think that is also, I didn't mention that before, but I think that's also one of the important values in presenting unfinished work, you know, not hiding it and keeping it to yourself and not wanting to show it to people, but, you know, as a teaching tool, letting people see the process. That no one is expecting themselves, even someone who is, you know, to some degree professionally an illustrator, is not expecting to go out and make absolutely perfect drawings. No. I mean, out in the field, I don't expect to. At home, I don't expect to. And the most important thing to me too is I don't want to. I really deeply believe that you show far more life if you have mistakes, that the mistakes are part of what captures the life of what you're seeing, because a perfect drawing of something is like a photograph, and those are lovely and those are important, but I don't connect to them as much. I don't see as much life in them. I don't learn as much from them as I do someone's initial rough drawing as they were looking at something, as they were thinking about it, as they were feeling it. I get so much more from that, even if it isn't anatomically correct. And it doesn't, I mean, it truly doesn't have anything to do with drawing skill. It's truly you translating essentially what you're seeing, what you're taking in through your eyes, translating it through your body into something onto the page that you can share with other people. And that, I think that captures something that absolutely cannot be captured any other way.
Yeah. And I think that's a really good distinction that you make, because when often when we're called on to be an illustrator for a scientific book or a journal, there's probably does need to be some accuracy because you are representing. However, yes. The point you're making here, and I think that's what really helps our listeners, is the point you're making here is just get out there and do it. In other words, whatever skills you have, you'll get better.
Right. And if your goal is and if your goal is to do perfectly scientifically accurate stuff, that's great, but
you can go
if you aren't there yet, also, this is also a really good way to get there, but you're not expecting yourself to do that kind of work in this kind of practice. This is, even if it doesn't produce what you want in the end, the process of doing this is getting you there because it's that process of observation that's critical, not what ends up finally on the page right then and there.
That's right. And often that journal is for you.
Right.
You know, when you first start, you may not have in mind at all doing a book or doing something that isn't really the scope. It's to be able to go back to that and see. One thing that you mentioned, and it just made me remember, we had almost 25 years ago gone to a location in the Smokies that had a recent fire. And we remembered that place. My daughters are now much older, we remembered it, and then we went back 25 years later.
Yeah,
we didn't recognize it at all. You know, we remember it with a creek that you could see, you could sit on the banks and all that. It was all grown up with trees and shrubs, and we were walking through it. It was a new experience, completely new experience, but we had no idea that it would recover in 25 years to the level that it had.
Yeah.
So I think that's part of what you must have experienced in doing this.
Yeah, well, it absolutely, especially after the first fire in 2015, seeing aspects of the geology and the hillsides that I'd never seen before. You could see all sorts of things that that were completely impenetrable, covered in shrubs. And then the second fire after 5 years opens things up even more. And it's, I mean, it's a range of things from the big details of seeing, you know, there's some really interesting geology in the mountains right there. And so seeing those interesting folds and shifts that you could only get hints of before. So big picture stuff. And then also small picture things too, walking past a completely bare bank and seeing the huge numbers of termite holes in the dirt there that, I mean, of course they were always there, but I didn't see them.
Right. What gets hidden? Just a reminder that the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists and scientists and members of the community to engage in conversations. And we encourage you at home to have conversations about what we've been talking today. We encourage you to go out and take a journal and go out and journal on your own and look around and explore the world around you. We'll be right back.
This is Dave Baghdad, host of The Kitchen Party Kaylee. I hope you'll join me every Sunday at 10 p.m. for the best music from Ireland, Scotland, Canada, and the U.S. The Kitchen Party Kaylee, Celtic music from across the globe and across town.
Welcome back. I'm having a conversation with Robin Carlson about the ways that we're moved by the places that we're in. But, you know, it brings up a question, Robin. All this is in the context. You talk about 2015, then 2020. you know, the occurrence of these events like fires and all that have to be being driven by global climate change, that frequency. And what does that mean for evolution? And what does that mean for that little lizard you were talking about when what was more an occurrence that was less frequent becomes a more frequent occurrence? And you have some insights on that, I think, from your observations.
Yeah, so it has been, it has been even, so this one canyon and its recent fire history has absolutely become even more emblematic of what's going on in California and the West and in other parts of the world too right now than I ever expected starting this. And I have had the great privilege to talk to some scientists too who've been working in this area and looking at fire frequency and what that has meant for these very habitats in this area and for Cold Canyon itself. And so I mentioned before that before the 2015 fire, it had been about 30 years since Cold Canyon had burned again. And that is still getting to be a fairly short interval for the chaparral habitat there. But still, that is, you know, enough time for most of the things that live there to replenish their seed banks to essentially to be ready for the next fire. So that first fire was probably fell within a fairly healthy fire regime. And so that, you know, it was probably a pretty good time for it to burn. But 5 years in chaparral is definitely closer together than a lot of the things that live there are prepared for. And so some of the issues are for the shrubs that don't resprout from their roots and from their burls that do need to regrow from seeds, they need time for those seeds after a fire to grow up into shrubs and to produce more seeds and for those seeds to get into the ground. And so it is starting to look like maybe some of those reseeding shrubs are not going to come back in the numbers that they were there before. It doesn't mean they're going to be completely gone at this point, but it does mean that the composition of species in the habitat is changing. And it also, for the non, you know, for some of the wildflowers and some of the not big woody shrubs, but some of the annual and perennial type wildflowers too, it will be changing their composition as well, because they also need time to grow up and set their seeds. And the plants that grow from bulbs too need time to regenerate. And so that composition is almost certainly going to be changing. And so what has also been interesting to learn is that I had been thinking that the time between fires was the most important aspect of how, whether the habitat was going to come back in the, essentially the same form that it was. But what these researchers are also learning is that the total number of times that a particular area has burned within a larger time frame, so like within the last 100 years, which is what we have records for, it may not be so much the intervals between the fires, but just seems as though three fires within the 100-year range may be a sort of a tipping point. And so this was the third fire for Cold Canyon in that 100 years. And so that actually may be driving more of the habitat change than just this, whether it was this 5-year interval or not. And so that has been an interesting thing to learn about. And then the other bigger picture thing about fires and climate change is that we do not have, there are actually, despite the fact that we hear about these huge mega fires in California every summer, there's actually not still enough fire happening out there. When it does happen, it's too big and burns, you know, too much of an area all at once. But there's actually still not enough fire. Even if you count those big fires, it's still actually not enough fire. That fire should be more spread out. And the other really important thing is that the fires need to burn at very different intensities and over different areas. So I had sort of mentioned before being surprised at the patchiness of how Cold Canyon had burned the first time. The really important thing for healthy fires and a healthy fire regime is that we have all these different kinds of fires, that we have really hot fires that help, you know, keep non-native grasses from taking over, that we have lower intensity fires that are the ones that are really beneficial, for example, for oak woodlands. And so I've, you know, definitely been coming to understand much more, not only do we need more fire, but we also need this great diversity in fire. And so as the climate continues to get here hotter and drier, that leads to fires burning much more uniformly, burning much greater areas in all the same way. And so what that means is there aren't these little pockets of habitat left for species to come back and recolonize the burned area. And it was demonstrated fairly well at Cold Canyon. You know, I got to see those pockets and see how, you know, lots of animals really never left the burned area because they had places to take shelter. I saw on trail cams deer wandering through the area. There was fire nearby and they're wandering through completely unconcerned because they've got places to go. It's burning, but it's not this big monolithic devastating force that wipes out everything for miles around. But we are having fires like that more and more. And so that's this really important balance. And that is definitely one of the open unanswered questions at the end of the book is, you know, it looks like there are some, I mean, there are many promising things about understanding fire better, but of course there are directions that we are headed in that are not good.
Right. And you're really bringing up, I think, two of the critical points about climate change. One is it's the unpredictability. You know, nature and farmers, for that matter, are dependent on some predictability, at least some in terms of climate. You know, they may be able to deal with a, you know, a yearly change in weather, but we're talking about major climate. But the other one is, and I think that was, you brought it up forward really well, is the frequency. So it's the frequency or infrequency, like you're saying.
Right.
You know, it's places that needed it, don't get it anymore. Other places get it too often. And you couple all those together and it really means nature is really competing with a rapidly changing ball game, which it doesn't usually do. It usually, you know, evolution is over time. And so this is very hard, on all species, when we have this going on. I know that in the book, you really wanted to get many things across, but I think one of the things you did leave us with, and that's what you were talking about just now, is you did leave us with hope. It's an unanswered question, but you did leave us with a lot of hope. You know, this could have been a book about how devastating fires are and how awful it is, but you didn't really do that with us. And you really kept us with, you know, these critters that were on a journey. It was just really great. I want to thank you, Robin Carlson. And until next time, I'm Mark Kiesling, reminding you to tune in again, where we'll explore more curiosities from the intersections of art and science.
You've been listening to Intersections, where art and science meet, with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Just a reminder, the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists, scientists, and members of the community to engage in conversation that explore the intersections between art and science. We encourage you to explore further in conversation with others. Any of the ideas explored in today's show at www.thedaVinciPursuit.com.